I'm William Jess Laird. This is Image Culture. Today, my guest is the photographer and film director, Jerry Schatzberg. Jerry started his career in the late 50s shooting fashion photographs for magazines such as Vogue, McCall's, and Esquire. Some of his most iconic photographs were made during this time, perhaps most famously his portrait of Bob Dylan for the cover of Blonde on Blonde. In 1970, Jerry made the transition to film with his first feature, Puzzle of a Downfall Child, starring Faye Dunaway as a model on the verge of a nervous breakdown. His follow-up film, The Panic in Needle Park, a gritty, realistic look at two heroin addicts in New York, starred Al Pacino in his first major role. The film earned Jerry the first of his four Palme d'Or nominations, including one win for 1973's Scarecrow. Jerry just celebrated his 90th birthday, and I was happy to visit him and make a portrait at his apartment on the Upper West Side. You can see that on Instagram at William Jess Laird. Here I am with Jerry Schatzberg. You grew up in the Bronx, right?
Yeah.
Where about?
Well, I started at Marshall Loop Parkway, and I keep saying that I remember my father, when I was one, pulling me in a little sleigh in a park across the way from where I lived. And I was telling that to some people, to a woman actually who was also brought up on Marshall Loop Parkway. She remembered the park, so I must have remembered that. Whether I was really one or two or three, I'm not sure, but I thought it was one because we kept moving. We lived there, then we lived on Plimpton Avenue, then Mount Eden Avenue, and then Weeks Avenue. I guess I remember Weeks the most. That's when I was able to play stickball.
Were you any good, stickball?
Just medium, you know, nothing spectacular, but more the people, you know. It was just a great combination of people, and I think that's what our young life is always, you know, our friends and how our parents never understand us.
And what did your parents do?
My father was a furrier. My mother was a housewife. My father also was a gambler, which is part of the backstory of the film I'm working on.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Like what sort of gambling? What did he bet on? What was his game?
Oh, he would go to, in the winters we used to go to Florida a lot, so he'd go to the casinos in Florida. There was a place over the bridge called Ben Marden's Riviera. He used to go over there with his friends and my mother. They used to go to nightclubs a lot and horses. And all through our life, I just remember him rushing home from work to out to Roosevelt Raceway to bet on the trotters at night. And during the day, because I worked there, I worked in the factory in the back with my uncles. My father was the salesman.
At the first shop?
Yeah, it was a loft, you know. But when they had nobody there, he'd be upstairs with his friends playing cards. So I do remember that a lot. When he'd win at the gambling casino, he'd buy my mother something nice, and then when he'd lose, he'd take it and huck it, you know.
One in, one out.
Yeah.
I guess it would have been what, the mid-40s? Something like that?
Well, I was born in 27. So I celebrated my 90th this year.
Congratulations. Yeah.
And I can remember, I grew up until I was about 13 in the Bronx, and then we moved to Queens, and then I went to Forest Hills High School. I went to into the Navy from school. I didn't graduate, but we automatically got a diploma if we were in our last year, if we went into the service, and I was a draft age, so I had to go.
What was your experience? I mean, was the war still going on at that time?
Yeah, I went in just as I turned 18, I think, and at boot camp up in Sampson, New York, and they were talking about another 2 years for the war, and I went in June, I think, and we dropped the bomb in August and changed everything, because we were expecting to be in for, you know, at least another 2 years. And there weren't too many choices for schools that you could go to. And I remember they had sonar, which I didn't know what that was. So I figured I wouldn't go to that school. And then the other one was pharmacist mate. So I figured, okay, I'll do that. So I went to school for that. And the bomb was dropped. And I was immediately assigned to St. Albans. It was a Navy hospital there. And so I was in about 15 minutes from home. So my father would drive me when I was off. He'd drive me back to the base. And I was on night duty once, and I sort of fell asleep. And I was caught and given the court martial. So I was restricted to the base, I think, for like 2 months. Then they came around with an offer to people if they wanted to go on a hospital ship. And we're still bringing lots of people back from the Philippines.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
You know, and so I said, well, you know, right now I'm just restricted to the base, but I might as well go somewhere and do something. So I got onto this hospital ship, and they had just come back with a lot of patients. And then their next duty, I don't know why, was down in the Caribbean. So there I was in the Caribbean, and it was so hot we'd sleep on the deck. I was just like on a cruise, you know. It was not bad at all. I went down
through
Trinidad and Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, and so we just traveled around distributing patients to different places and picking up patients. And
I guess all things considered, you got pretty lucky timing-wise.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think I was in for 2 years, but the war was over. Mm-hmm.
So how'd you go from, I guess you're a young guy, and you go off expecting to have this big experience, and it doesn't end up being as intense as maybe you thought. I'm sure you were scared in some way.
Getting out to hospital ship?
Well, if you go in, you think the war's going to go on for 2 more years,
yeah.
And, you know, and that must be pretty intense. And then you come back, and are you working with your family?
Yeah. I worked there for a while, and then I'd go. There was a big retail photo shop, camera shop, near where we worked. And I would go there for lunch, a lunch hour, and I'm the owner's son. I didn't think anything of time, so I would spend 2 hours walking around this place. Mm-hmm. My father would be furious when I'd get back.
you'd take a long time during the workday?
Yeah, an hour is lunch.
Yeah.
and it doesn't take 2 hours to eat a sandwich. Uh-huh. So one day I was sitting in the back, and I was reading the New York Times, and I saw an ad for a photographer's assistant, and I had no idea what that was. There was not much information. It was a name and a telephone number. So I called up to see what that was, and I told them my experience, which was nil. I had no experience, and he kind of laughed, but he said, come on in, I'll see what I can do. I didn't know it was an employment agent. I thought, I didn't think anything. I just was trying to find out. So he says, come on in, I'll see what I can do for you. I went in, and there was this man. His name was Bierman, and he had a lame arm. And he kept laughing at me because I had no experience at anything. And he says, I'll see what I can do for you. And the first place he sent me to was the Lillian Bassman studio. I don't know if you know Lillian Bassman.
No, I actually don't.
Yeah, she was a great photographer. She was one of Brodovich's protégés, and she worked for Harper's Bazaar. And her husband was also a photographer, Paul Himmel, and he was looking for an assistant. He was in Europe, and she was doing the interviewing. But I walked into this place, and it was like magic, and everything was black and white and touches of red, and I didn't know anything about this. I think I owned a camera, but when I was a kid, I had a plastic camera. Then I think when I got out of the Navy, I had seen this Argus C3, and I asked my family to buy me that, and they bought me that. And I didn't use it very much, I don't think. But something here I was just attracted to it. And but then they offered me $25 a week, and if I wasn't married and I already had a child and another one on the way, I would have probably taken it, but I couldn't. So I had an uncle that worked for a company that you'd rent your diapers. Each week they give you new diapers, you give the diapers back.
But diaper rentals?
Yeah.
It's kind of a crazy idea now,
right? Before that, you would take the company would take a picture and give you a free picture of your baby. Mm-hmm. And my uncle worked for that company, and he took me out with him, and he goes selling these people. And if you sell $9 worth of pictures, you get full commission. He would sell $30 worth. You know, he didn't understand what no meant. You know, they'd say, no, we can't afford it. No. He'd keep on going. He'd make the sales. And I hated that. So I said, well, yeah, but who takes the pictures? And he said, oh, no, you don't want that. There's no money in that. I said, yeah, but who takes them? He said, well, we have photographers. I said, and what do you mean there's no money? What do you get? He said, well, you get $2 a sitting. I said, yeah, and how many sittings you get a day? He said, well, they'll assign you 10. I said, well, 10 sittings, $2, that's $20 a day. Mm. It's a lot more than $25 a week, you know. So I said, no, I'll take the pictures. And he said, well, you know, and so I had to get a camera. I borrowed money from my mother to buy a camera. They tell you how to do it with a background. You take, what you usually use for your 8mm film, the screen that you pull up and all that, and then the baby sits in front. You put the baby on his stomach and fold his arms like this. And so most of the pictures are like that with the baby on his stomach because they don't have the strength to pull that apart once you lock them in.
Yeah, so you have to stay put.
Yeah, so I went to the first sitting, and they wouldn't let me in. They said, no, the baby's sleeping. We can't. I go to the second sitting. No, the baby's sick. We can't do it. So you end up doing two sittings a day. Mm-hmm. I realized where I was at. So I had to do something. So I prevailed upon my uncle to tell these people that I'll go out and sell for them. Mm-hmm. And I didn't like that, but I did. And then I put up with that for about a year, and then I called this guy again, Berman, and he remembered me. And he laughed again the same way he laughed the first time. But he said, come on in, we'll see what we can do. So I went in, and he sent me, the first place he sent me to was a catalog place, you know. And you walk in, the carpets, beautiful carpets, and nice offices, and it smelled of money, but didn't appeal to me. So I went, he sent me to the second place. The second place was a photographer, Bill Halpern. And when I got there, I think I was the fourth one online. He hadn't come in yet. His stylist said, listen, I don't know when he's coming in. Why don't the first three go out and have coffee? And then when they come back, the next three go out. First three go out, and I'm first online. About 5 minutes later, he walks in, so I'm first one to be interviewed. And I was very naive about the whole thing. I had no experience. In those days, you didn't have to have too much experience. You know, you're moving things, carrying things, cleaning the toilets, doing all of that stuff. And after 3 weeks, he wanted to fire me. And the stylist said, come on, Bill, he's only here 3 weeks, give him a chance, you know. And so he said, oh, yeah, okay. And so then I stayed with him for 2.5 years. And when I told him I was leaving, he offered me a piece of the business. Mm. So I did learn, and I did work there, and it was a great opportunity for me.
What were your responsibilities like? Like, what was it to be a...
I was the camera assistant, and then Jack Shannon, he was the darkroom assistant. Uh-huh. So Jack did all the developing of film and printing, and I did all the work in the studio. And if I needed somebody to help me hang the paper, Jack would come out and help me. And
were you shooting 8x10s at that point?
He was shooting 8x10s for color and 4x5 for black and white. But he worked also for Charm magazine, so he used the Rolleiflex as medium format for the magazine. But, that whole thing of pulling slides, putting it back in, turning it around, setting the lens and all that, it took me a little while.
I've only done it a few times. Like, you know, I guess that job has changed. The photo assistant job has changed.
Yeah, I'm always surprised when I see that somebody still has one. You know, they're beautiful cameras, the Deerdorf, 810 Deerdorf. But, you know, doing all that stuff and your fingers are getting in the way. So I stuck with it, and I became his best assistant. You know.
Nice.
And when I was getting ready to leave, I already had a friend of mine worked for a small advertising agency, so he gave me little things like photographing mannequins in store windows for them that they had some clothes on. Mm-hmm. And I got friendly with an art director. He said that he would give me an assignment. And I said, wow, okay, it's time for me to leave now. So I found a studio. I told Bill that I was leaving. He was very unhappy. That's when he offered me a piece of business. I said, no, I think I really have to do it on my own now. Mm-hmm. And I found a studio diagonally across the corner from where he was. It was a building that Tiffany, when they were silversmiths, they were started in that building. And now it was just one 80-year-old man who's a lawyer, I think, or an accountant, and another group of Hasidic Jews that were making ties in one loft. And then the assistants in those days, there were about 10 for different photographers that were doing test shots of all the gals that would come into town and needed photographs.
Right, yeah.
And I needed photographs, and I learned everything about photography working for Bill. Not mm-hmm. everything, but that's where I learned how to take a picture. And Jack was doing it first, so I'd see him, and he'd shoot one night, and then next night he'd spend time in the dark room, and he'd did another, so he'd do about 2-3 sittings a week. And, Fords would call him, Plaza 5, Wilhelmina eventually, all the agencies, because since there were only about 10 assistants that were really doing this, they'd watch, and they were doing pretty good photographs. Mm-hmm. So then he said, okay, I'll get you started. He did with the lesser agencies, and I started to build a reputation, and I started to get calls, and Bill was great. Bill let us use his cameras, let him use the studio at night, use the film, use the dark rooms, and in 2.5 years, I photographed a lot of women. Almost everybody that came into town passed by Jack, myself, a few other people. And
do you remember what that first big break was, what your first, you know, thing you shot was that was like a big thing?
No, because, you know, you can imagine the first time, and it's an, I wasn't a novice, because I watched Bill shoot. I knew how to work the cameras and all that. I just didn't have to deal with the models. You know, I'd probably copy a few things that Bill did and all that, but eventually you start to feel relaxed, and then you start to go out of the studio and do things. And but I think about 6 months after I was in the studio, I took my portfolio to Vogue and I got an assignment. Mm. So that basically started me there.
It's a kind of an interesting time for fashion photography too, because this must have been like the early 60s, I suppose, right?
It was the late 50s.
Late 50s.
Yeah, so I think I started my studio in 56. Mm-hmm. But so I had this studio now. It didn't do well for my my family life, because I was working day and night.
Yeah.
Yeah, so once I started photographing, I was just, after a day's work, and sometimes Bill would work until 6, 7, 8 o'clock at night, and then I do my stuff. I found myself sleeping at a friend's apartment on the floor, and then working at the post office at Christmas time to make extra money. And basically that's where it all started, But it did, as I say, it wasn't good for the family. And my wife and I, we eventually split up. We stayed married for something like 19 years. I think we split up when we were married, when I was married 6 years. And then I didn't divorce. We just stayed that way. And she went to Florida with the kids for 6 years. And then when they moved back, I'd see them more, and things were starting to get a little work. It didn't come fast in any way. You had to work at it. and you had to buy equipment before you could afford to buy equipment.
Yeah, it's kind of a prohibitive industry in that sense, And
because you needed cameras, you needed all the lights and everything else. And when I look back at the stuff I had in my studio and some of the photographs I have, my goodness, how did I have all that?
Yeah. I guess you just pick things up as you can.
Well, it's like an apartment. When you stay here for 40 years, get a lot of junk, and I don't throw anything out. And
I'm thinking you're going from working at your family's, you know, for a business and doing sort of these odd jobs, then all of a sudden you start to move into this world of fashion photography, which is, you know, maybe
I don't think it was that fast. You know, those things happen.
Yeah,
I
sure.
went to work for Vogue, but I still did my little jobs of photographing mannequins and windows mm-hmm. or whatever I could make a buck with, you know, and the work that I was given at Vogue was not the prime work. It was, you know, they needed, I would do the best job I could with what they gave me, but when it came out in the magazine, it might have been this big in the magazine.
Yeah, you know? a little front of book pictures.
Yeah, something, a tip, this month's tip of something, you know.
Well, what about some of your kind of iconic photographs? I mean, when did you feel like you started hitting your stride as a photographer?
Well, I think I did one or two good assignments for Vogue, mm-hmm. and that got notice. One in particular, called the Cha-Cha-Cha series, but that, when it came out in the magazine,
Are those this kind of silhouettes, like very high-key, you know, white...
White backgrounds.
Yeah, sure.
With the strange movements.
Yeah, of course.
And all that, yeah. And that was basically started from a conversation with Alex Lieberman, who was the art director of Vogue, and... I think it was Dior or Saint Laurent came out with a new shape, and he wanted the movements to be mm-hmm. all with shapes. Just don't disregard everything you've ever seen or learned and all that. And in the conversation, he said something like, people doing the cha-cha-cha, and that stuck in my mind. Right. I used to go to the Palladium during the week and watch all the locals, the real people, dancing. I thought they were so elegant in their movements and everything. I got hooked on that a little bit, so then I started these. And then I took two dancers from West Side Story, and I brought them into the studio, and I'd have them dance. And when I saw something I like, I'd stop them, and I'd have the model copy what they were doing, mm-hmm. and then I'd stick a lipstick in their hand and a mirror or something.
Yeah, it's like a little
give
effect.
A little fashion or something. And it hit, you know. And so I was getting a reputation. I stayed with Vogue about 2.5 years. And it was a time when McCall's had new management, new art direction, new people. And they were starting to do more interesting stuff. And I went to Lieberman and I said, you know, I'd like to work for them also, because I knew the people there now. And they wanted me to do some work for them. And he said, oh, no, you have to work only for us, and that's all. If you don't want to work only for us, then goodbye, Charlie. You know? I thought about it a while, not cleverly enough, because later on, after I did leave, I said, boy, I wish I was still working at Vogue, you know, because Vogue is a great... Well, they'll let you do anything. If they don't like it, they won't use it. Give it to somebody else to retake it, but they're pretty good that way. So I quit, and I went to McCall's, and I did some good stuff there, and then I was able to get back to Glamour. He wouldn't let me work for Vogue, but he let me work for Glamour, so I was doing stuff for them, and I was meeting a lot of people socially and all that, and I had, through August, the 60s was a great time for everything, and I was very friendly with the English photographers. And,
yeah, sure.
I would go over to London 10, 11 times a year.
Nice.
And any assignment that I said, I think I have to do that in London, you know, I'd go over there, and it was great fun. You know, I was very close with Bailey and Donovan and Duffy, and that's really where it was happening.
Yeah, I mean, that's the British trifecta there. Yeah. What about, I'm sure everyone asks you about this, because I think it's probably your most famous photograph, the Blonde on Blonde cover with Bob Dylan. When did you meet Bob?
Yeah, well, I started to photograph the Stones because I met them in London through Bailey.
Yeah. And, there's that amazing photograph you took of the Stones in drag in front of that
later on, yeah,
beautiful building.
I was doing them before that.
Uh-huh.
We were friendly. I was very friendly at first with Mick, and then I became... And later on, I became friendly with Brian because... And after I had met Dylan, photographed Dylan, he and Dylan were very good friends, so we'd all hang out together. I was photographing, had to be musicians, and there was a disc jockey there and a journalist, Al Aronowitz. I don't know if you know that name. He was a rock and roll disc jockey. And no, he's a rock and roll journalist.
Right.
And they were in the background talking, and I was photographing whoever I was photographing. I don't remember. And I heard them talk about Dylan. But I had a girlfriend that one time wanted to be a model, and she kept talking about Dylan. And I didn't know Dylan, you know. And she kept talking, Dylan. I said, yeah, I'll get to it. I haven't listened to him yet. And then Nico from the Velvet Underground, she wasn't in the Velvet Underground yet.
She's a model.
Model.
Yeah.
And she was saying, Jerry, you got to hear Bob Dylan, you know. And she'd find out that I was in London, in Paris. She'd come to my hotel, call me up, hey, I heard Dylan yet? And, you know, we had a fun thing going.
Yeah, sure.
Then I started to listen to Dylan. I started to listen to Dylan, and I got hooked.
Yeah.
And then these guys were in the studio, and they were talking. They had been with Dylan the night before, the day before. They were doing something. They went somewhere and all that. And I heard it while I was working. I said, hey, next time you see him, tell him I want to photograph him. Mm-hmm. Joking, serious, you know. And the next day I get a call from his wife who said, Bobby, here's, you want to photograph him? I said, yeah, I'd love to. And she said, okay, they're doing an album. And she gave me the address where the studio was and all that. I said, wow, okay. I went there. And as soon as I came in, he welcomed me. And he said, hey, man, you got to listen to this thing. They just recorded something. They were doing Highway 61 Revisited.
Great album.
Yeah. And so I listened to some of the music, and I was very impressed. I was a little intimidated, or maybe a lot intimidated, so I started photographing. And I was the only photographer there that time, but I'm sure I know a lot of people photographed him in recording sessions. Mm-hmm. And I got some pretty good photographs, and they liked them. Then I figured, okay, they like them. Now I'm going to see if they'll come to my studio, because in the recording studio, he's completely in control.
Yeah.
In my studio, I'm completely in control. So that's when I started to do the in-studio stuff. And then we'd go out once in a while to a concert in Long Island or the Forest Hill Stadium. And I got involved with him just after he did Rhode Island, just after he was booed in...
The folk festival,
but up in New England.
It's like Rock and Roll History 101. Yeah. Newport Folk Festival. Yeah.
And he was furious. He said, no, I'm gonna, this is what I do, this is what I'm gonna do. And he was right. But then the first concert I went to was Forest Hills, where they also booed him. And from there, we went to Albert Grossman's apartment in Gramercy Park, and he was sitting there, hey, fuck him, this is what I'm doing. And, you know, he did what he wanted to do, and he was right. But the wife that called me, Sarah, was the girlfriend I had before, who kept talking to me about Dylan.
So Sarah was your girlfriend before she got with Bob?
Before she met him. And she pursued him.
That's convenient.
Until it worked out. And I think it was a good marriage for a long time.
Yeah, sure.
They had a bunch of kids. And,
there are plenty of songs about Sarah, right?
Yeah. Well, you keep asking, you know, you say, oh, is that about... No, it's not about her, you know. And usually the one that you can't figure out the name is about her.
Yeah.
Marie is about her daughter, because she had been married before and she had a daughter. Mm. And then I stopped photographing him when he had his accident. And that's when I was going to start my first film. Mm-hmm. I was very much involved with discotheques through that period of time. He used to come with me to my discotheques. We'd go to other discotheques. We'd just hang out a lot. And whenever I had an idea I wanted to do, he would do it. And he was always very open to everything. You know, I'd give him some prop around the studio. He'd take and he'd do something with mm-hmm. it, you know. So it was really a good relationship. And then I saw him, I think the last time I physically saw him was in 1970-something. By that time I had done two, maybe three films.
Yeah.
And he always wanted to do films. And he wrote some and he was in some, and but he couldn't get it into his head that I did three films by this time. And how did you do that? You know, I said, well, you know, I just went and did it.
Yeah.
I just wanted to do it. And he said, yeah, but how did you know about how to do that and that? And I said, well, I didn't really. I said, but actually, I did some commercials for it. I did about 10 commercials. I hated it. I didn't want to do them, so I stopped doing them. But, you know, somebody says, get the best boy. And I said, well, what do they mean, best boy? And they tell me what the best boy is.
You learn the basics, being on a film set. Yeah.
Asking people what they're talking about.
Yeah, you know? Just like being a photo assistant, I guess.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's right.
Maybe that's a good. I had a bunch of pictures I wanted to ask you about, but maybe that's a good segue into talking about your first film, which, you know, I went to that screening you gave not too long ago, mm-hmm. Puzzle of a Downfall Child. Mm-hmm. How did that? Maybe I guess the first thing I wanted to ask about is the model who the film is based off of, Anne Saint Marie. So what was that like?
She worked a lot for Bill when I was assisting, and you know. We'd always sit on the side talking while Bill is on the telephone getting ready to do a shoot or something. Mm-hmm. But and we were friends. And then at that time, I was still married, my wife and I, and she and her husband. We'd go out together. But it disturbed me because I was getting ready to... I was asked to do the collection for Vogue. I wanted to take her to do the collection. And they wouldn't let me take her. They said, no, we've seen her too much, you know. And I wasn't in the business very long, so what do you mean? You know, I know people get a job and they work all their life at a job, you know, but not with models. Models sometimes work for 2 years, and now they work for a year, maybe 2 years,
yeah.
And then they're finished. And then majority of them go work in an office somewhere, you know.
Right.
But while they're working, though, they travel first class, they stay at the best hotels, they take the best restaurants, you know, and they're beautiful. And it wasn't until the 90s when I was way out of the business that they didn't have this thing of supermodel.
Right.
You know, that came later. But, I mean, the highest paid model at that time was Jean Patchett, and she made $60 an hour. That was huge.
Yeah.
But now they get $60,000 for a sitting.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
Or more, you know.
So you knew this model and
Yeah, so Anne was a friend, and she went through my my separation, mm-hmm. with me, helped me mentally, and but it bothered me that these magazines or these corporations or these big manufacturers say, no, we've had her too much in our ads or photographs, and they just dump them.
Mm.
And it gets to be a little difficult for them. And I think at one time I was just shocked to, because she was also a high paid model and her husband was a photographer, but I guess they lived high, mm-hmm. and used up all their money. And one time another photographer sent a notice around to most of the working photographers trying to take up a collection so they could pay their bills. And I just couldn't understand how that could happen. You know, this great model, you know. And she was great because when you look at their work, or if you have to do any of that work, you know, it's like being a great actor.
Yeah, sure.
You know, not everybody has the talent, but some of them do and some of them don't. And when you find them, they have the talent. I mean, it's just a miracle and it's just beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And the model that they made me take, she was quite nice and she did good photographs, but she didn't have that something special.
What was the experience of making that first film, of shifting and...
Well, it was great because by that time I'd already met Faye. I'd been sent down to...
Faye Dunaway.
Yeah, Faye Dunaway. I'd been sent down to Florida to photograph her for Esquire. She was one of the up-and-coming new stars, mm-hmm. new starlets. And I went down there. I did a sitting for Esquire. They loved the sitting. They published the sitting. I didn't think anything of it after that. And then she went on, she did a second film, and then she did Bonnie and Clyde.
Mm.
And after Bonnie and Clyde, she came back to New York, and her public relations lady, Marjorie Downey, said, why don't you call Schatzberg, see if we'll do some more photographs? Because by that time, I had a pretty good reputation.
Mm-hmm.
in photography. And so she called me, and I said, oh, she asked me if we could do some more photographs. I said, absolutely, yeah, I'd love to, you know. And I said, why don't we have lunch and talk about it? Well, and I went up to her apartment, and the place was a mess. I don't know, she just moved in, or was she just totally chaotic, you know. At one time, I think I labeled her as being organized chaos, you know. But she knew where everything was, and she said, oh, yeah, and she'd go into something and pull it out. And,
yeah.
And so we became friends. I started photographing her, and eventually we got together, you know. And and at one dinner, I remember the subject of film came up, and said, and I mentioned that I was, you know, involved with a film. I was trying to get a film on, and she asked me what it was about. I told her what it was about, and she just kept getting more interested, more interested, more interested. And for me, it was heaven sent something, because she was the hottest model, the hottest actress around at the time, because Bonnie and Clyde came out, and
yeah,
she was a big star.
Of course. Huge movie.
And then Newsweek asked me to photograph her. I did some really great photographs for them. And we were just, you know, we were very close. And it was, at one time we were talking about getting married, you know, so it didn't work out. And things always happen the way they're supposed to happen. You know, you don't argue with things. And but we're still friends. You know, she just moved back to New York.
I have a little sidebar, because it's one of the pictures that I kind of earmarked because I was interested in. There's this one beautiful photograph of Faye Dunaway crying.
Yeah, it's on the first sitting.
That was for Esquire.
Very first sitting for Esquire.
How did that come to be? I mean, what's that
I
picture?
Don't know. I'm in the middle of shooting, and she starts crying, and I don't know why, and I think I'm thinking, quick, did I say something? Did I offend her and all that? And she said, I don't know why. I, you know, it's. And then it happened to me again with Catherine Deneuve. I was photographing her, and she starts crying. Now, I think the only thing is they are so fragile, and you don't know what you say that may, is what you do or what action, you know. You just might say, ah, my God, you're so beautiful. That may do it, because Faye had a history of her father left the home, so she grew up without a father, basically. And maybe she associates or something, because they're very fragile actors, right. You know, both male and female.
It's interesting that was the first sitting, because I see that picture as just being one of the most intimate photographs of Faye Dunaway I've ever
seen.
I think
she was on a bed, she had a sheet wrapped around her, or something like that, and she just started crying. And they liked the photographs. Our people, uh-huh. You know, Marjorie Downey, and those people liked what we did. And so that friendship started. And since we were so close, I introduced her to Anne, and she was able to see her behavior. She was able to see her habits. She was able to just pick up so many things that are in the film. And I also had done 2.5 hours of tape of Anne, mm-hmm. getting her history and all that. And Anne was quite a character, you know, and she'd say things that, I used to speak Chinese. Really? How come? You know, and, well, my father spoke Chinese, you know, and none of it was true, but she'd make up these stories. Sure. And on the tape, Carol would hear that, and of course she put something in the film pertaining to that. And
there's so many of those great little details in that movie.
And a lot of that comes from the tape. And and when Faye and I were out in L.A., Faye and I had been together for a while now, and I entered an elevator, and somebody in the back of the elevator said, "You Jerry Schatzberg?" And I wasn't used to that, you know. And I said, yeah. And he said, you know, and he introduced himself. We met at Cy Litvinoff's house. There was a party. And okay. And we started talking. We both got off the elevator. We sat and started talking. He said, what are you doing here? I said, I'm looking for a writer. He says, well, what? And he asked me about my story. I told him something about my story. He says, you know, I'm on a film now. I'm working on a film now. And we had a writer who I think is just sensational. I think she's really great. The director doesn't like her work. He says, I said, can I read it? And he said, Yeah, and he sent me this script, and I just loved the script. It was her script to Petulia. Dick Lester didn't like what she wrote, and doesn't take anything away from him, because I think Petulia is a good film.
Yeah, sure.
And he just had a different sensibility. He didn't understand her humor and all that, but I just... So I called her up, and I asked her to come to the hotel and meet with Faye and I. And I thought, oh, she's going to just kiss our rings or something, you know, Faye Dunaway, a film. And she came, and she was very nice, very polite, very smart, and nice sense of humor. And I said, you know, my producer is an Indian now. I had Ismail Merchant wanted to produce the film. And he brought us over to India and wined us and dined us and all that. And then,
that's been a cool trip.
Yeah, but then he kept working in India.
Right,
I met this writer that I wanted to make a deal with. And I'm not the producer. He's the producer. I kept calling, and he kept saying, oh, yes, Jerry, I come soon, soon. not didn't come. And finally, I called him. I said, Ismail, I've got to make a move because I really like this writer. I had to do it. And he was very unhappy about that because he really liked the project. But he couldn't dump James Ivory. That's his partner.
Yeah, of course. Know? Yeah.
And so...
Legendary partnership, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I called her, and I had rented a house because I was determined to get this thing on now. So... and I called her and I asked her if she'd come up and talk to me. She said yes, and she came. And as soon as she walked in, she says, I can't stay very long because I've got my friend in the car. She has a very bad toothache, and I got to take her to the dentist. And I figured, oh, she's already planning her escape.
Yeah, it's not going to happen.
And so I said, oh, my goodness. I said, well, you know, I've got this 2.5 hours of tape. I'd love you to. She said, no, I can't listen to 2.5 hours of tape. I said, well, can you just listen to a little bit of it? Just 5 or 10 minutes, you know. Okay. So I put it on. She sat there for 2.5 hours.
Wow. Must have been quite a...
It's fascinating.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And she saw so much in it for her to work with. Mm-hmm. You know, and she just used it. I mean, she didn't use it the way Anne used it, but she used it the way she did. And she got all of her humor into it. And
it's probably a great treat for a writer to have that sort of material, you know, to have so much detail.
If you can get that.
And
of course, it's great for an actor, too, because then Faye was, she was open to Faye all the time, anytime Faye wanted to, because Anne already had a breakdown.
Right.
And she was coming out of it now. So if Faye could get that, she had the benefit of...
In reflecting mood.
Yeah, all of that.
Well, it's an amazing movie. I mean,
Well, you know, it didn't get very big. A couple of critics here picked up on it, but the majority of them just threw it away. And surprisingly, and maybe not surprisingly, the two major female critics panned it and panned so much of it. What's her name? Judith Crist and Pauline Kael. And as time went on, I just think it was a jealousy. Mm. It was a woman writing something that they would like to write.
Right.
And I've always felt that because they really weren't panning me. They were panning the writing.
Mm.
You know, panning this writer. And so if Pierre Roussien, the Frenchman, hadn't accidentally seen the film, you know, I'd still be cleaning toilets or something. No, but Pierre is a great film person. There's actually a documentary on him that Todd McCarthy, who's a writer for Esquire, he did a documentary on Pierre because Pierre has discovered so many people.
Mm.
And Cannes used to send him all over the world to look at films for them for their each year, you know, along with other people. And because I didn't get the whole story until I met Pierre. So he was in San Francisco. The film was invited to San Francisco Film Festival. And Pierre looks over the program, and as he says, oh, another fashion photographer doing a bullshit film, you know. And he was determined not to see it. And the day of the screening, he just had nothing else to do. So he said, I'll watch 10 minutes of it. And And he was hooked.
Much like Carol.
Yeah. And, I mean, all these things that happen, you know, it's luck. So he immediately called Universal and said he wanted to represent the film. Mm-hmm. He was a public relations guy. He was partners with Bertrand Tavernier. I don't know if you know Bertrand.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, well, Bertrand and he were partners in the public relations business and friends forever and ever. And I called them, along with about four or five other guys, my French mafia, because they all get together, they fight, they do this, and, you know. But he went back to France and started talking with Michel Simon, probably the leading critic in France. Michel saw the film, he loved it, and they started to talk to all different critics, and Paris was for me. Mm-hmm. You know? So the reviews and everything in France was terrific, and in America, the film came and went.
Well, you know, it makes sense to me because you know, when I saw that film, when I was trying to think about it kind of in context, and you look at what was happening in the United States in film and what was happening in France in film, I mean, it makes a lot of sense that it would resonate in France.
Well, probably, but I think France always had a little bit more courage
in
looking at films, because they were always into cinema, and you know, they had great artists there that were you know, it was a much more cultural place than this is, you know. And even today, I mean, you think of now I see some very nice films now. I don't know if the Academy is going to pay 10 minutes time for them. Because if you look at all the films that win in festivals in Europe, the ones that win here at the Academy,
it's pretty radically different. Yeah, absolutely. You know? And but I think Puzzle has that, you know, it has that psychological element. It has a you know, female protagonist.
Well, because of the liking of the film so much, we had a dilemma, because then Pierre told them that he would want to represent the film in France, told Universal, and they were delighted because the film had been panned here, and they just going to put it on a shelf and take their loss.
Get Second Life.
Yeah, instead. So, and then Pierre called me, and I was shooting Panic already there, and he said, I'm coming to New York, I'd like to meet you, and all that, and Pierre is quite a character, so listening to this Frenchman talking this way, and was for me, it was heaven. Somebody liked my film. And he came, we talked, we became friends. We're still friends, you know, and through thick and thin. And if it wasn't for him, as I say, I'd be who knows what. Because, well, I'd probably still be taking some pictures, you know, catalogs or something.
I guess I want to talk quickly, you know, before we run out of time, about Panic in Needle Park. I watched the film last night. Just because I was trying to get in the mood, the spirit of this. Yeah. Such a dark movie. I mean, like a really, you know, a heavy movie, an important movie. Was it hard to work on that? I mean.
Yeah. You know, first of all.
It's draining, I think.
Half the crew were former addicts. Uh-huh. So actually, there was one addict that was still
using,
and I didn't know it. You know, I would have questioned it, and it's a wonderful actor, but I didn't know until later that somebody told me, and then I found out it was true. But now that's not my life, not my lifestyle. I'm not even while I was researching the film, and I also had my discotheque still. I was working with them, and
what was the club you were?
One was Ondine, and one was Salvation.
Mm, right.
And
lots of stories from there, I'm sure.
Oh yeah. But with Ondine, I know a lot of people that died from drugs, you know, overdoses and, you know, things that went on. I wasn't crazy about that. And we were sitting, because Al and Kitty and I, because it was a great time to have Al, because he had nothing else too much to do. You know, he was doing some theater work, and he was doing very good theater
work. His first major film, right? His first starring role, right?
Yeah. He had a very small part, maybe 3 minutes, 4 minutes, in Me, Natalie, I think. Mm. And I had seen him on the stage in Indian Wants the Bronx, Israel Horowitz's play. And wow, I mean, I'm sitting in the audience and I'm looking at this guy's magic up there, And I say to my business manager, who was there because he wanted to sign up Al as a client, as his manager. And we're there together. And we go backstage after. And what I saw on the stage, which made my hair stand up, is this pussycat. You know, a different guy. I mean, what a talent. You know, and I said to Marty, if I ever made a film, this is about 3-4 years before I ever thought of making a film.
Right.
If I ever made a film, that's a guy I'd like to work with. And we went backstage, we met, the time went by, I didn't see him, I didn't have any contact with him. Marty did, so I may have seen him socially once or twice as part of a group. It was also, Al says to me, it's Faye Dunaway that really discovered him, because she told Marty she had seen this actor, and he was fantastic, and that's how Marty knew about him, that's why he pursued Al. So... yeah, so I'd go to all these places that the druggies hung out, you know, and there was a Wimpy's on Broadway in 72nd Street, I think.
The diner?
It's in the film as the coffee shop.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But it was a Wimpy's, you know, which was a coffee shop of some sort. And we were sitting there one day, and this addict comes in, and I think there was a step when you get past the door, and she... tripped on the step and fell right on her face. And you knew she was an addict. We'd been hanging around enough now to recognize them, to see what they were into. And I said to myself then, nothing's going to control me. Nothing like that. So I stopped smoking dope. I didn't smoke a lot, but I wouldn't smoke dope anymore. I stopped drinking. I just... didn't want something to control me, you know. I've stuck into it, you know. I have a glass of wine every once in a while, and usually when I'm in France, I don't drink here.
Never struck me as the using type, you know.
Yeah, no, I'm not a using type, but I was without realizing it. I was becoming a speed freak because I was taking a lot of pills. Because I take a pill to stay up all night
at the nightclub,
and then I take a pill in the morning to stay up all day in my studio. So I was
probably didn't help that you were running around photographing all these rock stars too.
No, that didn't help. Except that when I was on the road with Willie Nelson, I was on the road for about 3 months with the band, just hanging out. They loved to tease me and try to make me do something. Remember, it was the stuff that they used. I mean, evidently was like dynamite or something, because I remember Sidney Pollack, who was the producer of Honeysuckle Rose, one of the producers, he came onto the set one day, and Sidney played the game more, you know. They'd say, come on, have some dough, have a drag, and Sidney would, oh yeah, and he'd take it, and he did, and he turned gray within minutes. And we had to stop the bus. He had to get off the bus.
He got big leagues by Willie Nelson.
Yeah. And everybody's laughing, and they would always try, come on, just take a little, no thank you. And they're always, you know, Willie owns... police didn't matter. Nobody would bother Willie.
It comes with the territory, I guess, if you're Willie Nelson, right?
Yeah, but if you got some hard ass wanted to make a name for himself, he could have easily arrested him or done something. But
it's kind of amazing that never happened, given his you know, reputation over the years. Well, I mean, it makes sense that you'd be in researching Panic in Needle Park, it makes sense that you'd be in those spaces with Al Pacino and...
because Al had enough time. I mean, we spent about a month and a half together, three of us, just going around to places. We'd go to seminars at the hospitals. We'd sit in as if we were one of the...
Addicts.
And one day, I know this girl, her boyfriend was really kicking it, and he was doing very well. And she brought him back into it because she was looking. She had to get some stuff, and she just had him on the border, and she brought him in. And the guy who was running the seminar was really reaming into her. He was really screaming into her and all that. And he says, "How dare you do something? What do you think?" And I had to tell the truth, you know. And you got to say, yeah, no, that's a bad lady. She shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
But and you learn a lot from them, and I'm sure we picked up. And half the crew were, half the cast were addicts at one time, you know.
Well, the whole film, I mean, that's the thing, is it almost feels like a bit like a documentary at times, in the way that the camera kind of moves.
It got reviewed that way too. So it is more honest,
super authentic
than a lot of the documentaries of the.
And some of the shots, I mean, they're intense, because it's a close up of a needle in someone's arm, and it's I'm sure that's probably one of the first films that showed anything like that.
And I felt it had to be, because you don't experience it just by saying in the next room he's shooting up or something. You have to experience it.
Takes on a different tone.
Yeah. And I had some good people. One or two of the people in the factory had actually worked in a factory, so they know how to cut the stuff, how all that stuff is done, and they teach me,
it's a great scene where they're moving all around. Yeah.
And also, Adam Hollander, who's very straight, he's my cameraman. When I started doing my first film, I brought him out to L.A. because this transition from stills to film is a big transition when you think of how you work.
Yeah, of course.
You take up a camera, I think I'll go out and take a picture, and you take your camera and you go take a picture. Mm-hmm. And with this, so much preparation, so much that you have to do, and you can't walk past it. You got to go right to that mark, because the camera is all focused. So I took Adam out to show him this van that I had heard about, that the DP of I Spy had designed and developed. He had all the lights built and all the stands built and everything, so it could fit into its little slot. They pack it up, put it on a plane, and travel all around the world. And they take it off the plane, do a day shooting, And I showed him this, because I said, that's the way I'd probably like to work, And so he said, my training is at Wuersch, and they have a very good training there, a very good school and all that. And they do. It's where Roman went, Polanski went, it's Zanussi, Skolimowski, all these guys, they were probably in the same class, including Adam. And our training is more classic. If you tell me what you want, I'll get it for you. But I got to use what I like to use. So in those days, they were using these big Mitchells, and, it goes from here to here.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And they have him on their shoulder, and they're in panic. He's in a toilet, in this little toilet, and he's standing there. Adam is carrying the camera, and Adam's this tall.
Do you mean that scene with the baby?
No. The one where she steals his wake up.
Oh, and he's and Al Pacino's breaking down the door,
and he finally gets in.
So another great one. That feels like a real kind of fully fledged Al Pacino moment. It's crazy to see him do it so young.
But for these guys, I was having trouble with Kitty at the beginning, because with all we went through watching things, when she started working, she didn't use all of that stuff. She just reverted back to first reaction to something, which was not digging deep into it. And I had a conversation with the producer. I said, I don't know what to say, because I'm not really getting what I want from her. And I think maybe we'd be better off stopping now, bring somebody else in. And he didn't want to do that, and I didn't want to do that. We talked about it a while, and I said, okay, let me just talk to her. I called her up, and I spoke to her on the telephone, and I told her what I was really thinking. And she cried. I said, we went out, we saw this, we did that, we saw that, and you're not giving me any of that, you're not using it at all. You're giving me your first thing that comes into your head, you're not going past that. And I didn't know it, I did say something like, you got to go out in the streets again and find out where you're coming from. And that night she went out, and she... from that point on, she was getting better and better, and it worked. And she won the Best Actress Award in Cannes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it really, there's stuff out there that you got to get. And she had the tools. She just wasn't using the tools.
Yeah. Well, she ends up giving a great performance.
Oh, yeah. I think she's wonderful.
And so, and a crazy, a pretty huge, you know, transformation, like with that character.
Yeah, they wanted me to use Mia Farrow, and I said, no. I said, she's wonderful. But as soon as she comes on the screen, she says, oh, that's the gal that divorced Frank Sinatra.
It doesn't work in the same way, you know, because you...
Especially with Al, who's so real, and only the people in New York knew him from the theater, you know.
And he's so great with that. You know, he really feels kind of like a... He feels like a real New Yorker, you know, in the way he turns a phrase. And
I believe his brother was an addict. So he experienced a bit of that at home.
Yeah. I want to wrap up because I want to make sure we have time to do our photograph.
Yeah.
Thanks for talking.
You're welcome.
Thank you to Jerry Schatzberg, Genesis Publications, and Rizzoli. Also, a very special thank you to Wendy Keys for first introducing Jerry and I. This show is produced by Sarah Levine, and our music is by Jack and Eliza. Remember, you can see my photograph of Jerry at his apartment on Instagram @WilliamJessLaird. Have a great week. See you next time.